Hey everybody, this is Pierre Quinn and you're listening to episode number 95 of the Leading While Green podcast, where my mission is to help you live, learn, and lead with confidence. On this episode of the podcast, I am joined by Chris Ostergaard. Chris is a speaker, he's a facilitator, he is a researcher, an expert on innovation, and he is the author of the new book, Transforming Legacy Organizations, Turn Your Established Business into an Innovation Champion to Win the Future. And we talk about what keeps legacy organizations from pivoting toward the future and what your organization can do to get ready for what's coming next. We have a great conversation, so listen up. I know. It's been a long time, hasn't it? Listen, I've taken a break a few weeks from the Leading While Green podcast. I've been traveling, been speaking at conferences, doing trainings. It's been an incredible ride. We've recorded some great content. I mean, some amazing content. And I promise I'm going to share it with you on the Leading While Green podcast. Also did an early release of my new book, Leading While Scared, How to Find the Courage to Keep Going. And I've been speaking and training from content or using content from the book. And it's an incredible ride. And I promise I'm going to let you know what I've been doing real soon. We're going to cut up some of the content and bring it to you on the podcast and on YouTube and on social media. But it's been an incredible ride. Now I'm glad to be back in my home, back in my seat, back at my desk. Traveling is not always what it's cracked up to be, staying in hotels and eating on the go, but I'm extremely grateful for the opportunity to do what I enjoy as it relates to speaking and training and coaching and mentoring. It's great. I couldn't ask for anything more. Speaking of my new book, Leading While Scared, How to Find the Courage to Keep Going, there's a secret going around that there might be like a book tour in the works. There's definitely going to be a book signing soon if you are in the DMV area. But there might be a book tour in the works. I'm not sure. I'm not going to make any promises, but that's a distinct possibility. And I look forward to traveling and telling the story of how I came up with the book, Leading While Scared, How to Find the Courage to Keep Going. So I'm excited about this interview today with Chris Ostergaard. Chris is the co-founder and Chief Learning and Innovation Officer of Singularity U Nordic, the Nordic entity of Silicon Valley-based educational institution Singularity University. He's a sought-after advisor. He's a keynote speaker on innovation, on organizations, and corporate culture. And we have a great conversation on what it looks like, what it takes to transform a legacy organization and get it ready for the future. Here's my conversation with Chris Ostergaard. Today by Chris Ostergaard, a sought-after speaker, facilitator, researcher, and expert on innovation and legacy organizations. He is the author of the new book, Transforming Legacy Organizations, Turn Your Established Business into an Innovation Champion to Win the Future. Chris, thanks for joining me today.
Thank you very much for having me.
So, Chris, take us back a few years. When did you first get excited about this idea of studying organizational growth and innovation?
Yeah, so I mean, when I look back on my career, the red thread throughout it has always been understanding human motivation. What is it that gets us as human beings to do something or not do something? And I've worked in market research for many, many years where I explored that topic. And throughout my career, I started working more and more on the organizational aspect of it, working both with startups and also mid-sized companies and very large companies. And the whole notion of really trying to understand innovation, which is at the core of the book I just wrote, really so many arrows are pointing back to the notion of understanding human beings and human motivation and what is it actually that drives us as human beings and understanding of that in order to optimize for innovation.
So what was the impetus behind Singularity U as the co-founder and the chief learning and innovation officer? What really drove you to begin this particular project and venture?
Yeah, so Singularity U is an educational institution, and we were founded in 10 years ago with our headquarters in Silicon Valley at the NASA Research Center Ames. And I'm running Singularity U Nordic, which is the Scandinavian entity in Norway, Sweden, Denmark, Finland. And we are now having a number of different country partners around the world. And what we're about is creating education programs around understanding technological development and what is it that goes on with all within all of these many different technologies, being it artificial intelligence or robotics or even biology, that now we're talking about digital biology. So many different domains where we see technology accelerating the opportunities that we have and the potentials that are out there. And what we do in our programs is understand, use our domain experts to deep dive into these domains, understand what is going on and what will be going on, or what the future potentials are, and perhaps more importantly, what does that mean for us as individuals, for our organizations, and for societies as a whole. And for me, the journey and why this makes sense, it comes back to the notion of human motivation. Having been working in this field for many years and not being a technologist myself, 7, 8 years ago, I started reading a lot about this stuff, and it dawned upon me that, you know, if even like 10% of what these technologists were writing about the kind of future we were heading into, if even 10% of that were true, I had just had no idea what the world was like and what the world was going to be like. And that was massively important to understand, to ensure that we as human beings leverage technology to our benefit and to actually create the world that we want to see, and not just let technology sort of decide for us what kind of future we ended into. And that's what we're focusing on at Singularity U, and what is at the core of our education programs.
When you go back, I think maybe is it 20, 21 years when the iPhone first comes on the scene and really just changes the communication and technological landscape. We hear these stories of Steve Jobs and his push for innovation, and how sometimes there's this idea that in order to succeed, we can just keep doing the same things that we've always been doing. But you have these personalities like Steve Jobs and other leading visionaries and entrepreneurs who really embrace this idea of innovation. How do you define innovation, and why is a deep understanding of this concept important as organizations look to the future?
Yeah, so innovation is to bring something new to the world, ideas originally, initially, and then materializing them, which is the very important thing. It's really less about ideas and more about materializing those ideas. And that can be both in a market-facing situation, developing products, services, experiences, but it can also be more internally focusing when you innovate in order to optimize your processes, etc. But innovation is about bringing, materializing new ideas.
Well, and the title of your book is Transforming Legacy Organizations. And help us with an understanding of how you define legacy organizations. And then, based on your definition of innovation, how does that look different from, you know, I got a startup in Silicon Valley versus an organization that's been around 30 or 40 years? What does innovation look like for these two different ways of life?
Yeah, so legacy organizations simply meaning larger, more established companies that typically have a certain size, but more importantly, have history, have years where they have been in the market and a certain way of doing things. Sometimes we call that legacy organizations. And the reason that I wrote the book is because, you know, we seem to live in this age of the entrepreneurs, where we see these startups seemingly come out of nowhere and disrupt not just other companies, but entire industries. And most well known, of course, are the Googles and Amazons and Facebooks of the world, but many, many, many startups. And that is also true. We do live in the age of the startup, and the access to technology, it really has become democratized. I mean, and at the cost lowered so dramatically that it takes very little money actually to start a startup these days, as opposed to what it did 5, 10, 15, 20 years ago. But it also dawned upon me that working both in the startup space and with more established companies, the legacy organizations of the world, that innovation in the larger, more established organizations is very different from innovation in the startup. And, you know, I like to say that when it comes to the legacy organizations and innovation, there really is good news and bad news. And you know, the bad news is that innovation is much harder for them than it is for a startup. And simply because the systems are much more complex, they typically have multiple offerings, products, services, etc. Whereas startups, at least when they start up, they have one focus point, and then it's just about moving in that direction as good and as fast as they can. And so it's much more complex in the legacy organizations. But the good news is that no one really has a better chance of succeeding than they do because they have all the resources. I mean, they have money, they have customers, they have data, they have all of this stuff that startups really don't have. And that means that it's really not about the money. It's much more about mindset. It's much more about design. How do we actually design for innovation? And this is where the key lies and what these large established organizations need to understand. And increasingly, because of the accelerating pace of technological development and the doublings in computer power that influences all the other technologies and that opens up for this massive opportunity space of creating new, then innovation becomes more and more important in these large established organizations. And therefore, they need to design for that in a specific way. And given that they have these much more complex systems, really means that they actually need to innovate in multiple tracks at the same time. And I define those tracks as three different tracks. One that I call the optimizing innovations, which is, you know, the metaphorical extra blade on the razor. You know, when you see TV ads and you see the razor producer saying, now we not, don't have three blades, now we have four blades on the razor. Then a year and a half later, they don't have four blades, they have five blades, right? Now, so that is an optimizing innovation, if you like. That is a continuous optimization of the existing. And in its own right, it is good and right to do that. You need to do that. You need to continuously optimize. You spend a large portion of your resources and time and money on this, as you should. This is what pays the rent. This is what puts bread on the table. The problem, if you like, is that it's only for the short term, because what you're doing is that you're improving upon the past. And you also need to prepare for the future, and you need to also ultimately invent the future. And that's where the other two innovation tracks come in. So the second one I call augmenting innovations. That is where you upgrade your core. So this is where most of the digital transformation projects live that we hear and talk more and more about. So this is where companies go from analog to digital, digitizing their products, but also digitizing their processes. When, you know, a few years back, everybody had to become mobile first. Or now you see all the big companies at least starting to talk about they need to be AI first. And that will be a continuous journey. There will continuously be new technologies that we need to figure out how to leverage in order to be more efficient and in order to create more customer value. And a caveat here is that this is probably more about culture than it is about technology, and maybe we can get back to that. Then the third track is called mutating innovations. That's where you invent the future and where you challenge your core. So this is where you do your much more radical experiments, the what ifs of who we might be in the long run, whether that is 10, 15, or 20 years down the road. And we don't really know what that is unless we conduct experiments that are different from the ones where we're upgrading the core. And so that's the foundation of it. And that is obviously much more complex than having one product and just trying to scale it as most startups do when they are at least early on.
Hey, you mentioned these three tracks and culture, and sometimes it's difficult for organizations to be able to have these conversations, because sometimes the thought is that even discussing innovation, we are totally neglecting our original mission and foundation. You know, I remember studying ancient Roman culture and this underlying thought of older is better. And sometimes when we talk about making changes, even with founders or key people around, there's pushback because they're like, well, we're losing ourselves. How can those who are on the path of innovation in organizations ensure customers, ensure
vendors ensure collaborations that as we are innovating, we're not going to lose ourselves and we're still going to provide what we've been providing in the past?
Yeah, so I think it really comes down to strategy and purpose and who are we? What is the value that we want to create? And what is the path that we want to be on? And I think the notion of what value do we want to create is much more important than what products, services, offerings do we have. Mm. Because the value you're creating can most likely come from many other sources than whatever your core products are today. Now, so in the book, I give this example of a way how we need to explore the old questions, if you like, with new lenses. Mm-hmm. Like the old questions that any company needs to ask ourselves, such as which industry are we in and who are my competitors? And in fact, if you take the who are my competitors question, it has become much more complex, really. And so I play this little game I call 6 degrees of competition in order to explore it, to sort of show how important it is to analyze much broader than what we have a tradition of doing because of the technological developments and what this enables us to do, and to really take your value, the value you want to create as a starting point and not your product. So keeping it simple, I use coffee as an example here. So take 400 grams of ground coffee you can buy in the supermarket. If you explore what like the first, second, third, et cetera, up to the 6th degree of competition here is, then a lot of threats open up, but also a lot of opportunity opens up. Now, so if you are 400 grams of ground coffee you can buy in the supermarket, let's say it's Folgers because it's a big brand. Mm-hmm. Now, the first degree of competition to that, the most obvious one, is another brand, right? There are literally hundreds of them that are more or less providing the same exact same product. Now, and what coffee does is it provides the value. One of the values it provides is, you know, to get me more focused and energized on a task, right? That is why a lot of us drink a lot of coffee. Now, so first degree of competition is other brands. The second degree of competition could be tea, right? If you drink tea, you don't drink coffee. Third degree could be Red Bull, for instance, or Coca-Cola. It's cold, it's not hot, but it's loaded with caffeine and provides a lot of the same value. Fourth degree could be Starbucks, for instance. If you go to Starbucks and buy the coffee, well, you don't brew it at home. But if you get to the 5th degree, then something interesting starts to happen. We actually have those discussions in our boardrooms, in our management teams, in our product development groups. Are we actually exploring this 5th degree of competition also? And you can go further out in more degrees. And in most cases, the answer is no, we don't. We sort of stop at the 2nd or 3rd, maybe 4th degree of competition, and then we feel we have a full picture of what the competitive landscape looks like and what is actually possible, what is threatening us, and where we can move as organizations. But if we explore it further out, then whole new worlds open up to us. And the reason that we don't move out into the 5th degree and the 6th degree typically is because we live in these environments in our legacy companies, in our established companies, where we have a special way of doing things. And we have these status quo cultures. And that sort of refers back to, you know, our brains have a lot of biases inherent to them. And one of them is the status quo bias, which means that we would rather not lose than win. That is sort of a human default. For most people, there are a few exceptions, but for most of us. So rather not lose than win means that if we are to embark upon something that is new and different, then it needs to be pretty compelling in order to get us to do that. We would rather not get out of that comfort zone. And while doing research for the book, I came upon this amazing piece or amazing longitudinal study that two American social scientists have conducted, then called George Land and Beth Jarman. And what they did was that they did a study, 10-year-long study, with 1,600 children and a control group of 280,000 adults. And what they did was that they tested the children and adults for divergent thinking. Divergent thinking means having truly original ideas. The opposite of this, if you like, is convergent thinking. That's where you criticize the ideas and where you figure out how to make them work. Now, both are important, but divergent thinking is having truly original ideas. And what they found out was that at the age of 4 to 5, these 1,600 children here, 98% of them were creative geniuses. Hmm. Now, how large a percentage of the adults do you think were creative geniuses? Any guess?
I would say 30%, 40%?
Yeah, which is what you might think, right? But which is really ambitious. It was 2%.
Wow.
2% of adults were creative geniuses. And perhaps even more interestingly, at the age of 8 to 10, the percentage had dropped to 32%, and by 15, it was down to 10%.
Wow.
Now, so what this tells us really is two things. One is that our, you know, educational systems, and we also carry that with us into our other institutions, our organizations, our companies. But starting with our educational systems, they actively make us unlearn our inborn creative abilities, literally. But the good news here is that if you can unlearn, then you can also relearn, right? And that really is what we need to do. So we, in order to move away from our status quo cultures where we are only exploring the obvious and, you know, staying in our comfort zones, we need to relearn our abilities for divergent thinking, our inborn creative superpowers. We need to relearn those. And that means that we really need to transform our organizational cultures. And there's a bunch of tools for doing that. But that is really at the heart of it. We need to do that. And key here is that when it comes to sort of lack of innovation power in organizations, typically there's a lot of finger pointing going on. We point to others, like top management points to middle management saying they don't want to innovate. And you know, middle management points to the employees, and the employees, they point back to the management. But of course, there's human resistance to change. It's a real thing, and it's in the inborn biases are a part of that, and our lack of capabilities and our personality profiles. But even more important than our human resistance to change is our organizational structures. So if we talk in an organizational setting, and you sort of take your organization, the system, and hold it up against the individual, well, then the system will always win. The system is much more powerful than the individual in organizations. So that means that it is far less about making people change than it is about changing the system, which goes to what are our KPIs, what kind of behavior are we actually rewarding, what kind of innovation design do we have? Do we insist that any time of idea and innovations we come up with need to be compliant with our old processes, our old IT, etc., which in most cases, yes, we do. What kind of demands do we have, do our investors have, or our shareholders have, or whoever that has a stake in our organizations? Those things are far more important, really, than the human being, if you like, in the sense that human beings are remarkably adaptable to change if they have the right settings to do it within. And that is really a core dilemma here in organizations, is that, and that even starts if you are an entrepreneur, because having that knowledge means that you can actively design for creating an organization that is born innovative. Probably most entrepreneurs, if they're successful, is because they bring something new to the world or does something remarkably better than what is already out there. But having that awareness enables them to design deliberately to maintain that culture, which is what the big ones, the big tech giants of the world have done really, really successfully. They have maintained an innovation culture even as they grow and become legacy.
Well, one of the things that we see in highly successful companies is that they have more than one motivator for keeping people actively engaged and supporting the process, especially innovative processes. Talk about the challenge of just having your paycheck as a reward in an organization, and why and how organizations can create cultures that thrive by using multiple reward sources for their employees.
Yeah, so that's a key point, and there's intrinsic and extrinsic motivation that triggers human beings, and the extrinsic motivations are, for instance, your paycheck or a bonus, and intrinsic motivation is do you have a special passion for what you're doing, for instance? Do you feel that you're making an impact in the world? And all research shows that we need to feel that we are being monetarily compensated at a fair level, if you like. But above that, and a bigger paycheck simply doesn't make any difference. I'm sure you've experienced this. I know I have, and most people have. I mean, the 1 month after you get a raise, you're ready for another raise, right? I mean, right. You always want a bigger paycheck, right? That's sort of a default setting in us as human beings. So that simply means that it doesn't motivate us for very long. And in fact, there's a bunch of studies out there that show that when it comes to bonuses, that bonuses might in fact do the opposite of motivating us. It makes us more risk averse because we become so afraid of not getting our bonuses that it actually inhibits our innovation powers. That also goes for CEOs and their very big bonuses here. So in fact, that's not a smart strategy. So it's much more about creating intrinsic motivation, making us feel and also ensuring that we actually have an impact, that we actually make a difference for other people. I talk in the book about developing culture hacks in order to transform your culture and making it much more innovative. And there's some interesting ones out there. And you can literally come up with hundreds of different culture hacks. And one of the interesting things about culture hacks is that most of them are free. Again, it's not about money. It's about mindset and it's about design. It's about thinking about it and designing in the right way for innovation. Now, so for instance, how do you motivate people? And what kind of reward systems do you have? And at Google, they have this interesting reward in certain areas of the organization that they call the Courageous Penguin Award. And the Courageous Penguin Award, the reason that they named it Courageous Penguin Awards is because I'm sure you've seen this in nature films, but you see the penguins, they sort of gather at the edge of the iceberg, right? And then they all stand there, hundreds of them, and then they look down into the water, and then they're sort of like, who's going to take the first jump? The problem, of course, is that the first one jumping doesn't know if it will hit ice or if it will hit water. But once one has jumped and been successful, well, then the rest, the hundreds or thousands of them, they will follow. Thus, the courageous penguin, right? Mm-hmm. And so the reason and the cleverness creating this courageous penguin award and naming it as such is that they hand it out to someone in the organization who has dared to take that first leap, without knowing whether the person would be successful or not, without knowing whether they would hit water or ice, but daring to take that first leap and thus being an encouragement for the rest of the organization to also dare to take jumps even though you don't know if it will be successful. Now, so this is a simple hack, if you like. It doesn't cost anything. It's not about giving them a big bonus. It's simply about recognizing them in front of their peers for doing this. And it has a huge impact on the culture that you're creating doing this. Another interesting case is from Amazon. And Amazon have historically been really good at coming up with these different culture hacks. And they created what they call the institutional yes. And what it means is that typically in any organization, big or small, once you say yes to something, everything becomes difficult, right? You have to then find money. You have to set a team. You have to make roadmaps and Gantt charts and stuff like that. So there's a lot of friction attached to saying yes, really, which inhibits innovation. So therefore, it's very often easier to say no, right? And then it's out of the way and you can continue on the path as you have been doing for a long time. Now, so what they did at Amazon here that was genius was that they put more friction on the no and remove friction from the yes. And they did it through the institutional yes. So that means that if an employee goes to his or her boss and says, I have this idea, I really want to try it out, then the boss can choose to say no. But if the boss says no, the person has to write a 2-page argument for why they say no and post it on the intranet. So you think twice before you say no. They put friction on the no. And what it does is it's, you know, basic psychology here is that having to write this 2-page argument means that you have to do the analysis, which means you have to activate your prefrontal cortex, the new part of the brain. You have to do an actual analysis. The default, the gut reaction, no, doesn't activate the prefrontal cortex. It only activates the older parts of the brain, your gut feelings, right? Your intuitions. And so by putting friction on the no, they actually make you do the analysis, and that opens up for much more innovation. Now, again, this doesn't cost anything to do this. It's not easy to implement, though, because it demands that whoever chooses to create the institutional yes or the courageous penguin or whatever other culture hack you can come up with, it demands that there's some ambassador who says, we're doing this, and then they insist on doing it also the 10th time that everybody isn't super excited about it. But it speaks volumes about the type of culture that you're trying to create. And we need to see these types of encouragements in organizations that can actually help transform the organization and thus enable people to thrive and to become more innovative.
When we're looking at these hacks, and I love the stories that you tell, how can organizations use stories as a cultural hack? How can doing a better job of telling the story of the organization have long-term impact both internally and externally for the organization?
Yeah, so as human beings, we are storytellers. It's how we navigate the world. It's how we make sense of the world. So everything is a story, if you like. We have from ancient times created myths or big stories that help us make understand the world. If we don't do it scientifically, then we find other stories. But even the monetary system, if you like, is a story, right? It's a big story that we've invented and where we have decided and all looked each other more or less in the eyes and said, yeah, now we agree this piece of paper is now worth $1,000, right? But I mean, it really isn't unless we decide it is. And the only way that we can sort of convince each other that it is through our storytelling. So our entire societies are built upon us as human beings telling stories to each other. And it's not any different. The Courageous Penguin Award is also about a story that we're creating, which builds into a bigger narrative we have in our organizations around us becoming an innovative company and wanting to be an innovative company and having a purpose, being a purpose-driven organization, saying we are in the world because we want to make a positive impact in the world. For instance, as we see more and more companies do, we see a lot of startups that are actually born purpose-driven, but we increasingly see the legacy organizations now adopting the UN Sustainable Development Goals and incorporating that into their strategies. We see movements such as the Benefit Corporation movement. My own organization, Singularity Nordic, is also a benefit corporation, meaning that we are a commercial organization, but we also have an impact dimension. And the powerful thing here is that it's for us as human beings and as storytellers, it's incredibly motivational to be a part of organizations that, you know, what would you rather work for? An organization that is solely aiming to make unknown shareholders rich or an organization that is trying to make a positive impact in the world?
Great conversation with Chris Ostergaard about his new book, Transforming Legacy Organizations. Many of the organizations that I work with could be categorized as legacy. And I know sometimes it's challenging having conversations about innovation, about change, and about doing things differently. But that's exactly what we're going to have to do to get ready for the future. If you want to learn more about Chris's work, check it out at SUNordic. That's SUNORDIC.org. And also check out his book, get your own copy of Transforming Legacy Organizations. I'll put some links in the show notes for you to be able to check those things out and learn more about what Chris is doing in Silicon Valley and beyond. Hey, that's all I got for this episode of the Leading While Green podcast. You know it's my mission to help you live, learn, and lead with confidence. So until next time, take care and God bless.